John Allen presents the Creepy Crawl Podcast. Hey, creeps, welcome back to the Creepy Crawl Podcast. Creepy Crawl Podcast. Creepy Crawl, Creepy Crawlies. That is something the Mansons did, and it influenced the name of the show. Although I'm not glamorizing the Manson family, their mischievous adventures, well, they were called Creepy Crawlies. Speaking of Manson, that is the topic of today's show, a look into the Manson girls. But first, I am your enigmatic and mesmerizing leader, John Allen, alongside my imaginary co-host Woodrow, and that pretend background music you hear, or at least are pretending to hear, is Short Dick Man by 20 Fingers. Why, you ask? Well, I'll tell you, creeps, because Charles Manson and small penises go together like Rama Lama Lama Rama Ding Dong. I screwed that up, but that was from Greece. Not like Euros and Falafels, but the musical, Greece. Like, Rama Lama Lama Ka Ding Ka Ding Ding Dong. I can't do it. But do you know what, speaking of musicals, do you know what brings music to my ears? Everybody that's been supporting the show. All of the sexy people. And how do they do it? Well, they go to patreon.com/creepycrawl. Or they go to Venmo at Jonathan-Allen-154. You know what else they do, creeps? They follow me. Yes, they go to Twitter at WriterJohnAllen, no H, and they join the Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/TheCreepyCrawlPodcast. Now, research for today's episode occurred on May 11th, and on this day in history in 1812, the classic dance The Waltz was introduced into English ballrooms. Many observers at the time considered this dance to be disgusting and immoral. In related news, time travelers from then to the present day have been reportedly exploding spontaneously upon seeing the WAP dance on TikTok. Let's get to it, kiddos. Don't wash your hair or your body, like a hippie. Turn that volume dial to witchy, and creepy crawl with me. So once upon a time, back in the 60s, there was a dirty hippie commune known as The Family. Yep, y'all know them. Charles Manson's family. They spent their nights drugged up, having orgies, and listening to leader Charlie Manson prophesize about Helter Skelter, a ridiculous theory about this supposed time in the near future when a race war would break out. It would be black people against white people, because apparently that's the only two races in America. I don't know if he thought the other races would sit it out, who knows. But in his Helter Skelter theory, even though I think the African American population's 12%, 13%, small number, they would defeat this apparently large contingent of white people in this supposed race war. And during this time, he would hide his family in the desert. And once the black people beat the white people to take over the world, they would just suddenly be like, duh, we don't know what to do. And they would turn to Charles Manson to lead their new nation. Yep, Charlie Manson thought that there would be a race war, black people would win, but then they would need to find a white guy whom they just defeated an army 10 times their size of to lead them. That is Charles Manson logic. If you've ever heard Charles Manson speak, logic is something that eludes him. But this is what that was. And yes, people believe this stupidity because drugs. Do you ever wonder what's behind the evil we experience in life? They say behind every great man is a greater woman. That's true. Well, Charles Manson was great at what he did. What he did, not so great, obviously. In the 1960s, the thought that a woman would possess the savagery to commit the atrocities against other women in the manner that it went down with the Sharon Tate, Abigail Folger, and Rosemary LaBianca murders, that was an unfathomable thought. For years, the Manson girls, as they are known in true crime speak, have been considered to be the genesis of the concept of women consumed by a festering malevolence. Really, creeps, the Manson girls, they were the straw that stirred the drink. The old Charlie boy was all talk. I would venture to say, even though they were women, they were the ones with actual balls, and Charlie had none. It was disgusting what they did, but Charles Manson, he wouldn't exist without the Manson girls. They did his bidding, very sadly, but without them, he'd just be another loser who's about 4'10" and thinks that he can write music. Now, certainly many women killers have committed heinous and horror movie level killings prior, but things were different in 1969. Combining a cultural revolution with television, celebrity, and drugs, the sinister reign of Charles Manson seems to shine brighter than most, but in reality, Manson was a tiny piece of trash, a coward who implored others to do his bidding through, brainwashing, drugs, and a bizarre yet unshakable charisma. Essentially, the myth and lore of Charles Manson would not exist without a little girl power, albeit the worst kind. But who were these women? Who were the Manson girls? Were they truly the devil's favorite demons? Not quite, and maybe. Nature versus nurture is on trial here. So let's take a look at the women who effectively ended the free love era of the 60s over two nights in August of 1969.
Hey lady, you got the love I need. Baby, weren't that enough? Oh darling, 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 walk a while with me. Got so much, so much, so much.
Boy, did they have good music in the 60s and 70s, eh? So when speaking about the Manson girls, there's sort of this evil triumvirate. There's basically three women that were behind the massacres and the sinisterness of it all. But outside of the circle, I do need to speak about one of the Manson girls. She is something else. So she wasn't there. She didn't participate in the disgusting killings in 1969, But, creeps, we must speak about Lynette Squeaky Fromm. She was so fucking weird that she just has to be included in the Manson Girl vernacular. A trivia bomb. While living on the Spahn Ranch, George Spahn, who was like 124 years old and blind, yet somehow sexually active? Upvote there, sir. Gave Lynette Fromm the nickname Squeaky, based on the sound that she made when he touched her. Had I been in her shoes, one, I would have stretched those shoes out, and two, my nickname would have been Vomity, because every time he touched me, that would be the noise I would have made. So basically, Manson pimped her out to the owner of the ranch in exchange for a crash pad. While Manson girls Leslie Van Houten, Susan Atkins, and Patricia Krenwinkel stood trial, Squeaky Fromm, who was one of Manson's most fervent followers, led a group of Manson cult members who camped outside of the courthouse in a weird show of support. In short, old Squeaky was a sexually active parcel for almonds. You figure that out? That's a fancy way, creeps, to say a fucking nutbag. A sexually active parcel for almonds. A fucking nutbag. So, Lynette Fromm Squeaky was born on October 22nd of 1948 to William Millar Fromm and Helen Benzinger. As a wee lass, Lynette performed in a dance group known as the Westchester Lariats, and they toured in both Europe and the U.S. in the 1950s and made appearances at the White House as well as the Lawrence Welk Show, which would have been like winning The Voice, something like that, for that era. It's also funny she made that appearance at the White House because she doesn't have a great history with presidents. We'll get into that. Now, Squeaky Fromm, basically, her family moved to Redondo Beach in California, LA County, right? And during this time, it's the late 60s, hippies, all this is going on. Like pretty much every dirty hippie, she began to abuse drugs and alcohol, and her grades at Redondo Union High School plummeted. Side note for trivia again. Squeaky Fromm, or Lynette at the time, she befriended the late comedian and, well, eventually murdered, not she didn't murder him, but he was murdered by his wife, the late comedian and Saturday Night Live star Phil Hartman at Orville Wright Junior High School. Phil Hartman was friends with Squeaky Fromm. Hartman would later describe her as, quote, very sweet, very shy. Everyone else who has met Fromm has described her as kill it with fire. So, and I'll get into why I keep using the term dirty hippie later, but yeah, these were dirty, dirty hippies. Squeaky graduated from high school in 1966. Her father convinced her to attend El Camino College. Squeaky Fromm lived at home for about 2 months before she got into an argument with her dad, and this led to her being booted and kicked out, and she became homeless. I imagine the argument was like the following. I'm going to be Mr. Fromm. Lynette, take a fucking shower, please. In 1967, a depressed Squeaky Fromm met Charlie Manson at Venice Beach. Manson had recently been released from prison, and though much older, his attitude and philosophies appealed to her because she was an impressionable young lady. He had an almost godlike way to look into the souls of the lost sheep that he attracted. And when he uttered, "So, your old man kicked you out too, huh?" it was checkmate for the pint-sized snollygoster. Squeaky Fromm immediately decided that Charles Manson was a psychic. She messed up. She got the psych part right, but she should have went with psych. Oh, not psych-ick. Manson walked away from Fromm, and Squeaky picked up her belongings and followed him like a puppy. She'd have been better off following a greasy turd down the toilet pipes. just my opinion. Squeaky Fromm found Manson's persona appealing, and the two became fast friends, and they traveled together with other young people, including Mary Brunner and Susan Atkins. She lived with the Manson family at Spawn Ranch, where they worked for their keep. Well, Squeaky worked much harder for her keep because old man balls are gross. Then came the idea of Helter Skelter. Then came Charlie drugging people, but himself not quite so much to maintain control. Then came the murders. Now, she was not involved in the infamous killings, I must say. I must also say again, she was a fucking grotesque lunatic who was 4 cents short of a nickel. When Manson and fellow defendants Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Leslie Van Houten carved X's into their foreheads, which for no-name Manson would eventually become a swastika, Squeaky Fromm and her fellow manure zombies followed suit. They proclaimed Manson's innocence, and they preached his apocalyptic philosophy, thank you Woodrow, to the media and anybody outside of the courtroom who would listen. Squeaky was, however, convicted of attempting to prevent Manson's imprisoned followers from testifying, as well as contempt of court when she refused to testify herself. She was given a short jail sentence for both offenses. Fromm and fellow cult member Sandra Good later moved into an older attic apartment in downtown Sacramento because they wanted to be near Charles Manson after he was moved to Folsom Prison. Seriously, all of this for the world's greatest Napoleon complex, Charlie fucking Manson, and his pro wrestler gimmick personality. I guess he had that, though, in spades, old Charlie did. That being personality. So, following the incarceration of Charles Manson and the Manson Girls, Squeaky Fromm was not finished doing the work of the cult. Prior to a Led Zeppelin concert in Long Beach, California in 1975, old Squeaky knocked on the hotel door of Danny Goldberg, who was the vice president of Led Zeppelin's record label, that being Swan Song Records. Good old Squeaky Toy was drugged up, glassy-eyed, and infested with nervous tics all over her face. Quite the sight. She frantically asked to meet with Led Zeppelin guitarist Jimmy Page to warn him about the imminent evil which she supposedly saw because now she's a psychic. Knowing at this point in 1975 how interactions between Mansonites and famous musicians went in the past, Squeaky was thrown out of the door like Uncle Phil used to do to Jazzy Jeff in The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. But it gets better, because she hadn't squeaked her way into absolute lunacy quite yet. Oh no, creeps. Remember what I did earlier? I foreshadowed something about presidents? Well, in 1975, she attempted to assassinate then-President Gerald Ford. Which is ridiculous, because he was a useless president, kind of a dumb fuck. Really would have made no political statement. He could either exist or not exist. He's just one of those people. Makes no difference. So, that happened. She pointed a loaded gun at the president during an event in Sacramento, but the gun went all Grateful Dead and jammed. Sorry. Secret Service, of course, quickly arrested Squeaky Fromm. The assassination attempt of President Ford earned Squeaky a life sentence in a federal prison in West Virginia. Sad story, right? Story over, right? Well, no. Because, if I may rhyme, Squeaky was sneaky. In 1987, she escaped prison and was the subject of a nationwide manhunt? This dirty mattress is like that thing on my genitalia. She won't go away. She's like Rasputin or something. She was recaptured 2 days later, wandering down a backcountry road just a few miles away from the prison. Squeaky Fromm kept up a correspondence with Charlie Manson while they were both in jail. After serving a 34-year sentence for the assassination attempt, she was somehow released on parole in 2009. She currently lives in upstate New York and is married to an ex-con and is said to be a good neighbor, much like State Farm. Hi, Jake from State Farm. Can I get the John discount? Now, there is no word, I'll say, on whether or not she squeaks still to pay the rent in her apartment. That's what you call a callback right there, folks. Now we get darker. Creeps, it is on to the Hell People. Leslie Van Houten was born on August 23rd of 1949 in the L.A. suburb of Altadena. She grew up in a middle-class, church-going family, along with an older brother and two adopted siblings. Her mother and father divorced when she was 14. She began taking LSD, Benzedrine, and hash at the age of 15. Then she ran away for a time, but returned to complete high school. Pretty, petite Leslie Van Houten was actually the homecoming queen at her high school before the downfall. At the age of 17, she became pregnant, and this is weird, she was forced by her mother to undergo an abortion, and Van Houten's mother informed her sometime later that the procedure could not be referred to as an abortion as the fetus was too mature. She instructed Leslie to bury the late-term aborted baby in their fucking backyard. Well, Woodrow, you can see right away how healthy this family is. As healthy as a snowman in August? Top of my head, folks. Top of my head. Leslie Van Houten later would state that after this thing with the baby that's almost born that she aborts and buries in her backyard, well, I guess it would be just, what, obstruction of a corpse at that point. She felt, quote, very removed from her mother and harbored intense anger towards her. Well, what a twist. Who would have thought she would have such feelings after that? She developed a huge interest in yoga for a while, which I recently found out that the Catholic Church I grew up in considers to be a sin. Yes, yoga is considered by the Catholic Church to be a fucking sin. Are you kidding me? So, creeps, never do Pilates or P90X, because them's the devil's sweat right there. Leslie Van Houten also took a year-long secretarial course, but opted to become a dirty hippie living at a commune. And then she was Mansonized. Yes, after a few months in the dirty hippie commune in Northern California, Leslie Van Houten met fellow future cultist, as well as one murderer, Catherine Scher and Bobby Boussoulet, and moved in with them and another woman during the summer of 68. The orgy life didn't work, and the four broke up after jealousy, and Catherine Scher left to join Charles Manson's commune. Now, Leslie Van Houten, at this point, she is 19 years old. She decides to follow Catherine Scher. She was mesmerized by the little coward Manson. Did you know that Charles Manson creeps taking a leak, urinating, has the same stream and powerful effect of a mouse tinkling on a cotton swab? It's true. Professor Claude van der Bloggen von Science wrote about that in some paper. Yeah. Leslie Van Houten soon begins to believe that Charles Manson is a returning Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ. No, I didn't repeat that last word. I was just the second Jesus Christ was an exclamation like Jesus Christ. Yes, and that makes sense because when thinking of Jesus, one does conjure images of racism, drug dealing, and the pungent aroma of patchouli and sour armpit sweat. She phoned her mother to say she would not be making contact with her family again, though she did burglarize her father's home twice to provide for the cult. Manson decided when they would eat, sleep, and with whom and when they would have sex. He also controlled the LSD, giving followers larger doses than he himself took. Manson later said, quote, "When you take LSD enough times, you reach a state of nothing, of no thought." According to Leslie Van Houten, she became, quote, "saturated in acid and could not grasp the existence of those living in a non-psychedelic reality." Leslie Van Houten did not participate in the Sharon Tate murders and did not know that they had occurred until the following morning. But this wretched dearth of moral fiber, she would get her chance. In fact, the following night, she would get her chance because Dancin' Manson did a weird jig that led him to believe the atrocious Tate murders were not witchy enough. The group of Charles Manson, Tex Watson, Leslie Van Houten, Clem Grogan, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Susan Atkins, they stopped at a house in Los Feliz, which would be the home of Rosemary and Lino LaBianca. Manson was always a pussy, as we know, so he entered the house with Tex Watson and then left with Susan Atkins, Clem Grogan, and Linda Kasabian. Now, we've got the people left behind in the house. You've got Patricia Krenwinkle and Leslie Van Houten. They found Rosemary LaBianca in a bedroom where she was resting, while her husband had fallen asleep in the living room. Tex Watson put pillowcases over Lino and Rosemary LaBianca's heads. Then he tied an electrical cord from a lamp around each of their necks. Rosemary started struggling. Meanwhile, husband Lino, who had been tied up in the living room, started screaming as Watson began stabbing him. Rosemary LaBianca grabbed a desk lamp and swung it at Van Houten, who fought with her and knocked the lamp away. Van Houten then held Rosemary LaBianca down while Patty Krenwinkle tried to stab her in the chest, but the thrust of the fucking knife was so hard and cruel that the blade actually bent on Rosemary LaBianca's clavicle. I mean, damn, creeps, that is rough. These are some brutal-ass murders. So, Van Houten called for Tex Watson while this is going on, and he burst into the bedroom and stabbed Rosemary LaBianca several times. He turns then to Van Houten, hands her the knife, and told her to, quote, "do something," since Charles Manson had instructed Tex Watson to make sure everyone had actively participated. This would be a typical display of power, I think, due to overcompensation. I mean, why couldn't he have just bought some stupid pickup truck, even though he doesn't work in construction like every other micro penis out there does? Leslie Van Houten stabbed Rosemary's lower back and buttocks over a dozen times. Van Houten later told zombie friend Diane Lake that she had stabbed someone who was already dead. The autopsy indicated that some of the 47 stab wounds Rosemary suffered had indeed been inflicted postmortem. Like, that is literally the definition of overkill. Like, Jesus Christ, lady, take some fucking lithium. So, Leslie Van Houten was sentenced in 1978 for her role in killing Rosemary LaBianca. It took, for some reason, 3 trials and nearly 10 years for her to be convicted. Today, Leslie Van Houten is incarcerated at the California Institute for Women in Corona, California. This is the same facility that houses fellow Manson disciple Patricia Krenwinkel. However, prison officials, they do ensure that the 2 former Manson girls do not have contact with one another while in jail. Of course, Leslie Van Houten has been a model prisoner, and she's repentant about the Manson murders. You know, just like how every murderer finds God or whatever predictable bullshit. She became a quasi-celebrity, befriending eccentric director John Waters, who has no soul, and actually actively sought for her release. No fucking way. Direct yourself just out the door there, John Waters. Van Houten has stated that she is, quote, deeply ashamed that she allowed herself to be manipulated by Manson. Well, I think there's some evil in you that allowed yourself to stab someone 47 times. Not sure it was all Charlie's fault. Don't get me wrong, Charlie's rotten in hell where he needs to be, but unless you're talking MKUltra, can someone have that much control over you? 47 times. The parole board has denied Van Houten parole at least 19 times. We can only hope that there will be 47 denials, one for each cowardly knife attack on Rosemary LaBianca. So, Leslie Van Houten, you are a hell person. Woodrow, FTG, I think FTG. Fuck this gal. The next hell person slash Manson girl on the list. Number 2 out of 3, well, 4 if you count old Squeaky, is Patricia Diane Krenwinkel, who was born on December 3rd in 1947 in L.A. Her parents, just like Van Houten, they divorced. She was 17 years old at the time. Old Patty stayed in California with her father, who was an insurance agent, while her mother moved down to Alabama. After high school, Pat Krenwinkel moved to Alabama with her mom and attended a Catholic college, where I guess she couldn't do yoga. Ha! She had taught Sunday school in the past and had thought about becoming a nun. But spoiler, she did not become a nun. Not because of the murder, but because she really liked yoga. Okay, I can't get over that. After only 1 semester, Krenwinkel dropped out of college. She moved back to Cali with her half-sister Charlene and got a job as a processing clerk. In September of 67, the Summer of Love, well, sort of, just ending the Summer of Love, she met Squeaky Fromm, Mary Brunner, and Charles Manson on a Manhattan beach. Not a Manhattan beach. That's silly and makes no sense. There's no beaches in New York City. She met them on Manhattan Beach in California. Moving on. The one-time secretary joined the Manson family immediately after meeting Charlie at a party. She was, of course, young, 19, and impressionable when she found herself swept up in the Manson rhetoric. After making love with Charlie, which was probably the most boring 17 seconds of her life, hell person Patricia Krenwinkel decided to go with him and the girls to San Francisco, leaving her car and final paycheck behind. What an idiot. Who would who leaves money on the table? Within the Manson family, Patricia Quenwinkle, I sound like Barry from Big Bang Theory. Old Patty had a quiet but intense personality. She helped take care of the family's children, and she was fully dedicated to Charlie. In the summer of 1968, she and some chick named Ella Bailey were hitchhiking in L.A. when Beach Boy drummer Dennis Wilson picked them up. That was something that happened back then. Dennis Wilson invited them to stay at his Sunset Boulevard mansion while he went to a recording studio. Well, when he came back hours later, Charlie and the rest of the gang are there. And so began the relationship between Dennis Wilson and the Manson family. Later that same year, Patty Krenwinkle was arrested for possession of marijuana after she and some other Manson family gals gave LSD to some local youths in Mendocino, California. Fast forward to August 9th, 1969, at the Tate residence on Cielo Drive, one of the most haunted drives, streets, etc. in America. After the initial break-in, chaos ensued. Patty dragged coffee heiress Abigail Folger from a bedroom to the living room and repeatedly stabbed her. When Abigail Folger tried to escape following the first round of stabbing, Krenwinkle chased Folger as she ran outside screaming. According to Krenwinkle, she pinned Folger to the ground and continuously stabbed her. I told you, these are very brutal crimes, y'all. Folger pleaded with her, quote, "Stop, I'm already dead." I mean, ugh, that just boils my blood. It's so sad and tragic. But old Patty continued to stab Abigail Folger so brutally that Folger's white nightgown, she had a completely white nightgown. The police thought it was a red nightgown the next day. They had no idea it could have ever been a white gown. They thought this was a nightgown purchased that came red. That's how bloody this was. This episode is about the... They had no idea it was the white gown, blah, blah, blah. After stabbing Folger, Patty goes back inside and she summons Tex Watson, who also stabs Folger. And this episode, again, it's about the Manson girls. It's about the people who actually ran the Manson machine, which was the Manson girls. But I do need to say this about Tex Watson. If he were to be naked from the waist down, it would resemble the smooth nothingness of a Ken doll. Anyway, Tex Watson was a coward. Oh, God, I just want to punch him. Are they on the list already, Woodrow? Did I put the Mansons on the list? The whole family? Double check. He's on the triple list with Hitler. It's triple secret list. Okay. During her trial, Krenwinkle said, quote, "I stabbed her, and I kept stabbing her. When asked how it felt, she replied, 'Nothing. I mean, what is there to describe? It was just there, and it was right.'" BRB, I need to take a drink of water, because this bitch makes me sick. Patricia Krenwinkle participated willingly in more killing the following night at the La Bianca home on Waverly Drive. Krenwinkle got a fork from the kitchen and stabbed Lino LaBianca with it. She then used a rag to dip in his blood and wrote "Death to Pigs" on the walls. This was part of Charlie's idiotic plan to somehow pin the murders on black people, to start that race war called Helter Skelter, because he had no creativity of his own. Oh, God, it's a fucking Beatles song. Oh, another trivia note, creeps. Krenwinkle also tried to write out Helter Skelter, but spelled it Helter Skelter. Right. Helter spelled H-E-L-T-E-R, but this dumb bitch spelled it H-E-A-L-T-E-R. Helter Skelter. What a tragically inept simpleton. This colonoscopy bag has less going on upstairs than a one-story house. Once again, Big Patty, as the terrible nickname Manson gave her, goes. Once again, Big Patty began stabbing Rosemary LaBianca, but the knife bent, and she couldn't actually stab the struggling woman. Just think about that. Fucking Big Patty. You know what else is stupid about you, Big Patty? Your nickname sounds like a fucking gimmick promotion at Burger King. At her trial, Krenwinkel was found guilty on 7 counts of murder. As of this episode, Patricia Krenwinkel is 73 years old and is still imprisoned at the California Institute for Women in Corona, California, along with Van Houten. She is currently the longest-serving female prisoner in the state of California. As an inmate, Krenwinkel has not displayed any of the characteristics of a Manson girl. That's because she's a sociopath and they hide shit. She is, can you guess, creeps? Involved in the prison's rehabilitation programs, and she found God. Boy, God sure goes missing when these people have their freedom, but once they're in prison, he's just jumping out like the fucking Kool-Aid Man. So, looking back at the Manson murders, Krenwinkel has called herself, quote, a coward. Well, we can agree on one such thing at least, bitch. Krenwinkel has spoken out against the idolatry of Manson and speaks out against each new generation of people that romanticize Manson as a hero or savior. That's great and all, Big Patty. Still, you can go fuck yourself, you Burger King gimmick. And what do you say, Woodrow? FTG? FTG. Fuck this gal. Well, creeps, it's time once again for the Woodrow Comedy Minute that lasts longer than a minute. Woodrow has been listening to some old Charlie Manson songs while I'm recording, and he is not happy with my sideway glances. What? What do you mean? Why am I putting all your business out there? Do I need to remind you about the time you put my Okay, creeps, let me tell you something. Woodrow, you know what he did? He took a screenshot of my search history and inboxed it to everybody on my friends list, and my grandmother still to this day sends me recipes about tossing salads. This is incredibly frustrating, pretending that I'm a salad aficionado, okay? My search history is what it is. I own it. Whatever. Anyway, what's on the agenda today? Hippie jokes? Kind of on topic, but weird. I mean, how old do you think our audience is? And by the way, so I've been calling them dirty hippies. There's a reason. Nowadays, boom, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, you see these beautiful women with this beautiful flowing hair, and they've got a crown of flowers, and they're wearing a sundress, and they're running barefoot through a meadow. And people are like, oh, OMG, I'm a hippie like this. Well, no. That's not exactly what hippies were back in the day. Like, at all. Maybe 1% of them, maybe they intended to be like that. But Instagram hippies are a fantasy. Back in the 60s, just look at footage of Woodstock. It was gross, okay? So, let's get on with these jokes. Joke 1, creeps. What do you call the wife of a hippie? Mississippi. Oh, I get it. Like the state, Mississippi, but it also sounds like Mrs. Hippie. I'm Punderstruck. Okay, let's get going to joke two from Woodsy. What's the difference between hockey players and hippie chicks? Hockey players shower after three periods. Okay, gross, dude. Factual, but gross. I told you, creeps, that hippie's dirty. Okay, creeps, last hippie joke from Woodrow. How many hippies does it take to screw in a light bulb? Hippies don't screw in light bulbs. They screw in filthy, dirty hippie tents. Ah, they really were gross kids. No flower tiaras and anklets and sundresses and blah. It was like a big swingers convention inside of a dumpster, I promise you. Well, creeps, that's our Woodrow. Now back to the show. Now, creeps, we get to the nastiest of all nasties. That would be Susan Atkins and her smugly face. What's smugly? It's a combination of smug and ugly. Her smugly face and her stupid doll baby voice. If you ever hear this... I'm sorry, I don't ever call women bitches, but if you ever hear this bitch in an interview, she's got this doll baby voice because she wants to sound innocent and likable. Well, not happening. So, she is pure evil. When Lucifer has diarrhea, it is not called diarrhea, it's called Susan Atkins. Born Susan Denise Atkins in San Gabriel, California on May 7th of 1948, she grew up in San Jose as the middle child of three. When Atkins was 15, her mother died of cancer. Her father sold the family home and all of their furnishings to pay the hospital bills. Susan Atkins began failing school, and her father became an alcoholic who frequently left Susan and her younger brother Stephen to fend for themselves. Well, that's sad, I'll give you that. Her father eventually abandoned them for good. Susan and her brother moved to the rural Central Valley town of Los Baños, which I believe translates in Spanish to the bathrooms, which is weird, where her grandparents lived. Susan Atkins enrolled in high school and got a job as a waitress, but was overwhelmed with the stress of trying to care for her brother, go to work, and go to class at the same time. At one point, she and brother Stephen were in foster care. Susan Atkins dropped out of high school in the 11th grade and started drifting. Years later, she would describe her frame of mind during this period as, quote, extremely angry, extremely vulnerable, and directionless. Except she would describe it in her little baby doll girl voice. The petite, dark-haired teenager hitchhiked to Washington, then Oregon, where she accepted a ride in a stolen car and was arrested on charges of car theft, as well as concealing stolen property. She was released on probation and moved to San Francisco, where she worked briefly as a stripper at a North Beach bar. It's 1967, and it's Haight-Ashbury, San Francisco, the mecca for dirty hippies. Yes, dirty hippies, Haight-Ashbury, 1967, summer of love, baby, and Susan Atkins, the stripper, is there. Well, she meets Charlie Manson. He called himself and his followers, quote, slippies, who posed as peace-loving hippies while planning a hair-raising assault on society. Speaking of Manson's terrible nicknames, Susan Atkins was given the nickname, for some reason, Sadie Mae Glutz, which is stupid as fuck, as well as Sexy Sadie, which proves that the eyeglass technology of the 60s was seriously lacking. According to Manson prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi in Helter Skelter, the legendary 1974 best-selling book on the case, Susan Atkins was instantly drawn to Manson, who of course seduce girls by playing against their, or playing on their insecurities. Douchebags today who try to be players, they call that negging. You know, you throw a negative out there and the girl's supposed to, oh my God, this guy doesn't think I'm all that, so I'm in love with him. Whatever. When I seduce a girl, I don't call it negging, I call it begging. Wah, wah, wah. So, she testified under questioning by Bugliosi that before she met Charles Manson, she had felt that she was, quote, lacking something, but then I gave myself to him. And in return for that, he gave me back to myself because I talk like a doll baby. He gave me the faith in myself to be able to know that I am a woman. Nope, not a woman, no. Sorry, Sadie Mae Glutz. Women don't do what you did to other women as well as a full-term baby. Your genitalia was female, but that's where womanhood ends for you, you gross hag. In October of 1968, Susan Atkins gave birth to a boy and named him Zizozisi Zadfrak Glutz, because Charlie wanted that. Infamous or famous, these LA types sure do love terrible baby names. Looking at you, Apple Paltrow. Motherhood did not slow Susan Atkins' allegiance to Charles Manson. She would later never see this baby again, thankfully, by the way. I looked into that, and the baby was adopted by normal people with normal names and normal households. And his mother, his real mother, who adopted him, was not a stripping psychopath who talks like a baby and murders people. So, yeah, so that's good. Before the Tate-LaBianca murders, Atkins was involved in the murder of a man named Gary Hinman. Then came August 9th of 1969 on Cielo Drive. It is such a hard... I can't even get into the details because it's too extreme for even a podcast. Atkins was instructed to kill Wojciech Frykowski, who is a friend of Roman Polanski, who owns the house, the famous director. In the craziness, she's instructed to kill Frykowski in the craziness and managed to tie his hands, but froze up before she could actually kill him. So he springs loose, and the two of them get into a fight. Atkins stabbed him in what she claimed was self-defense. That's like Al-Qaeda saying 9/11 was self-defense. Also, it appears spell-checked changed my copy of Al-Qaeda to Al-Quesadilla, and now I have to go to Chipotle tonight. So as the scene dissolved into morbidity, Susan Atkins held down actress Sharon Tate, the beautiful Sharon Tate, 9 months pregnant, ready to pop any day. Susan Atkins later confessed to killing Sharon Tate, stabbing her more than a dozen times as the star of Valley of the Dolls pleaded for her life, but mostly pleaded for the life of her unborn son, who did die in the womb. Quote from Atkins, "Woman, I have no mercy for you." This fuckstick had a baby of her own a year earlier, mind you. Quote, "I was alone with that woman. She said, please don't kill me. And I told her to shut up and I threw her down on the couch. She said, please let me have my baby. Then Tex came in and he said, kill her. And I killed her. I just stabbed her and she fell and I stabbed her again. I don't know how many times. I don't know why I stabbed her. She kept begging and pleading and begging and pleading, and I got sick of listening to it, so I stabbed her. After the stabbing frenzy, she tied a rope around Sharon Tate's neck and tossed it over this ceiling ledge type thing and connected the other end in noose form to the neck of celebrity hairstylist Jay Sebring, who was Sharon Tate's lovelorn ex-boyfriend. Then she wrote the word pig on the wall in Sharon Tate's fetal blood. Creeps, you've heard of the Atkins diet? In this case, that diet would consist of the crud on a truck stop restroom floor, as well as flop sweat and an unrivaled vacuum of emotional intelligence, with a side order of dwindling brain cells that live in a dusty cavern of loneliness. It was Susan Atkins who later broke open the case when she bragged of her brutality to two of her cellmates, telling them she had even licked Sharon Tate's blood from her hand as the actress was dying. One of the prosecutors, Stephen Kay, called Susan Atkins, quote, the scariest of the Manson girls. When she went on trial for the Manson murders, Susan Atkins was originally sentenced to death. She responded by taunting the court, yelling, you better watch your own kids, and you best lock your doors. Susan Atkins was sentenced to death, but due to a change in California law, her sentence was reduced to life in prison. And I'm actually, for one, happy about that, because life in prison is way crueler than being able to just end it all. This bitch applied for parole 13 times and was always denied. I'm pretty sure the parole board was probably laughing before and after she even entered the room. As a prisoner, Susan Atkins had a change of heart. Of course she did. But you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube, bitch. She became a Christian, just like Krenwinkel and Van Houten and Tex Watson. At least Charlie Manson died as a jackass and never attempted to become a Christian. But no, she was a Christian in her soft voice, and she apologized for her past crimes. Even members of the prison staff advocated for her parole. Idiots. But to no avail. In 2008, Susan Atkins was diagnosed with brain cancer, and we can only hope it was painful and gut-wrenching. We can only pray that it was sheer misery for this bitch. She pleaded with the parole board one last time to be granted her freedom due to this illness, and once again, she was denied, just as she denied Sharon Tate's pleas. Susan Atkins died in prison in 2009. She was 61 years old, which means that she lived on this earth 61 years more than she deserved to be. And Woodrow, FTG, I say FTG, fuck this gal. The brutality of the murders and the crimes committed by the Manson girls helped to display to the world the power that a charismatic leader could possess. Manson was able to sway his group of young followers and brainwash them to his way of thinking. The Manson girls represented the ability of an evil cult leader to manipulate and control the minds of impressionable young adults. But back to nature versus nurture. Manson wasn't a killer himself. Not physically. He was a coward. So, are people born killers? Does groupthink and gang mentality bring out the evil that quietly tremors below? Was Manson indeed this powerful? Or was he just the nudge that these women needed to reveal their inner evil. I'm no shrink, but it definitely makes you wonder. Regardless, this is one of the darkest chapters of this American book, and those two nights in August of 1969 would not have happened without the Manson girls. Men mostly kill. That's a fact. But the concept that women are not so savage, and I don't even know what advantage I'm taking with this. It's almost, again, like girl power, but it's such a weird subject. But I guess what I'm trying to say is women are just as powerful as men, and they can be just as evil if they want to be. I hear so much in the true crime community, women killers, it's so bland and not really that interesting. It's always a nurse poisoning somebody or something like that. Well, I think what the Manson girls did on two nights in August of 1969, it makes all the other serial killers, the male serial killers, look like amateurs. But anyway, little Charlie Manson, yes, he was only the coach, but the women were the players on the field, and they played their macabre game for keeps, and they played it well. Well, creeps, that's our show. Quite a chilling expose. It is, or it was, a brutality that still amazes, even in our desensitized times that we live in now. So, with that, let's end on a happy note and make today's pretend outro music Happy by Pharrell. You know who makes me happy? All the lovely people that have been helping the show and continue to do so. To join these lovelies, please go to patreon.com/creepycrawl or give me a one hit on Venmo at jonathan-allen-154. You certainly must follow me on the Bluebird. That handle is at writerjohnallen, no H. And do join the Facebook group. That is facebook.com/groups/thecreepycrawlpodcast. That's all for now, my beauties. That's a lot to take in. I need to watch cartoons or something to just forget about the depths of humanity. Until next time, stay away from weird little men. Recognize that no one is Jesus Part 2. And Creepy Crawl on.